Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there life beyond the planet Earth, and how can scientists discover and understand it without ever leaving the solar system? Where once it seemed that planets themselves might be a rare phenomenon in the universe, astronomers now realize they are plentiful. And among all those billions of bodies orbiting stars, maybe 100 million with the right attributes to sustain life, perhaps even better than our own planet. Joining us to talk about the latest research is Dimitar Sasolov. He is professor of astronomy and founder and director of the Origins of Life Initiative at Harvard University. He's also author of the new book, The Life of Super-Earths, How the Hunt for Alien World and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. Dimitar, welcome to THINK.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we can talk about finding life on other planets, we should start by talking about what it takes to find those planets to begin with. What observations can we make from Earth-bound telescopes and orbiting telescopes that suggest the presence of planets orbiting other stars?
Astronomers have already figured out several ways in which to discover the presence of planets around other stars. We use them successfully for the past almost 15 years now since the discovery of the first planet orbiting another sun-like star. Now we have in excess of 700 confirmed planets. We call them exoplanets for short, and more than 2,000 candidates, particularly a space telescope, which has been in orbit now for 3 years, called the Kepler telescope. It's a NASA mission, which uses a specific method, which we call the transiting method, which is slight dimming, periodic dimming of the star when a planet passes in front of it. It's like a mini eclipse, if you will.
And in fact, in June of this year, Venus will cross, we will be able to see it sort of passing in front of our sun.
Absolutely. Mark your calendars. It's June 5th. It's in the afternoon. Venus is passing in between us and the sun. It will project a easily visible black disk on the shiny surface of the sun. And it's the last time Venus is going to do that this century. Next time it will be more than 120 years from now. So I would say it's a pretty good reason to take time off.
This is our one shot, essentially.
Yes.
So, okay, it's one thing to find these planets and to see that they are orbiting in front of these distant stars. What other information can we glean based on simply being able to observe them visually?
We've managed to do a lot in understanding what these planets are made of, even some of their surface environments. Almost to the surprise of our own community, we didn't believe that we'll be able to make such progress even in 10 years ago. If you had asked me, I would have said no way. What we've managed to do is, of course, we discover a planet and we know its orbit almost immediately, but with the transiting method in particular, you also get to measure the planet's size. You get its diameter from the amount of dimming it impacts on the star. And that can be a very accurate measurement of its size. Then we have a different technique where we measure the slight changes in the color of the star, which correspond to it being pulled slightly by the planet back and forth. That gives you the mass of the planet, how weighty the planet is compared to its star. Now, having the mass and the diameter, means the volume, you get the mean density for that planet. And we've discovered that we can tell between a rocky planet and a gas giant planet or a water world.
And obviously, you need a rocky planet to have life, anything like the kind of life we have on Earth.
Indeed, this is the realization we've come to in the past 10 or so years, is that the way we understand life and mind you, we don't have a definition for life or any basic understanding for its nature. But we have our example of living creatures here on Earth, and its basic chemistry is the same between a microbe and a human being. It's the same basic chemistry. And that basic chemistry requires certain conditions, temperature, solvents like water, and minerals. And those conditions are not that common in the universe that we astronomers have studied now for 100 years. I would argue that the only places which are really conducive to this kind of chemistry and hopefully the sustainability of life are planets similar to Earth, rocky planets with some water on their surface and with a relatively good atmosphere which could keep some of this water liquid.
So let's talk about this term that you use, super-Earths. What is a super-Earth and what makes it more likely than other sorts of planets to potentially evolve life?
A super-Earth is just what the name implies, a planet which is slightly larger in size than the Earth itself, up to a factor of 2 in size and maybe 10 times in mass. Now, a super-Earth, as we discover now, could be a very rich family of planets. Some of them are water worlds, others are probably just like the Earth ourselves, our own planet. There is no super-Earth in our solar system, but now we understand it was just a coincidence of sorts. Super-Earths are very common out there, very plentiful around other stars. Just a progression of planets like the Earth, except bigger. Mm-hmm. And maybe the most important thing about super-Earths is to realize that, in a certain sense, it's a family of planets to which our own Earth belongs. So our own Earth is a super-Earth, if you look at it just from a scientific point of view.
So is there any reason why there couldn't be, why there might be, in other words, are there usually one, do you think, one super-Earth per solar system, or is there no limit necessarily?
That's the question which we answered in science just in the past 2 years or so. Originally, we didn't know what to think because there was not a single super-Earth in our solar system, so we thought maybe they don't even form mm-hmm. often. What we find now, and that's one of the very exciting discoveries coming from the NASA Kepler mission, is that super-Earths are not only plentiful, but they like company. We've discovered a very large number, I would even say unexpectedly large number, of planetary systems with 2, 3, sometimes even 4 super-Earths orbiting around the same star in orbits which are fairly close to each other.
And in addition to having perhaps a somewhat larger mass than Earth and a larger size, super-Earths often have tectonic activity that resembles that of on this planet. Why is that so important?
Tectonic activity is important to a planet which we look for active chemistry, complex chemistry, and hopefully signs of life. What we call tectonic activity, as our listeners know, of course, is volcanoes, active gases coming out of fissures somewhere on the surface. But particularly with Earth and super-Earth, also the recycling of materials. That is the bigger question of plate tectonic activity, where in addition to volcanoes, there are also areas on the surface where the crust is being subducted, just like along the Andes and in other places on the Earth, where plates are recycled through the interior of the Earth, and then the materials come back again. This happens very slowly, of course, over millions of years. But it's an extremely important process over the long term for a planet in order for it to renew its surface, to keep its surface always chemically vigorous. And that is something which is very important to life because it sustains a fresh source of both energy and minerals and chemicals, which, of course, are very important, as we know, to all forms of life.
And obviously, these super Earths would need to be able to maintain an atmosphere so that they could hang on to the chemicals and certainly the water that they have.
Precisely. And this is where some of the main points of my book come to explain why the family of super Earths has such a special standing when it comes to understanding life on other planets and how often this could happen and where we should be looking for life. Because super Earths are relatively large, they have easy time holding on to their atmospheres. And we already know from our own solar system that planets which are smaller than Earth in size and mass tend to lose their atmospheres very quickly. Their tectonic activity, their volcanoes cease to erupt, and they become essentially dry, cold deserts with very little chance for that complex chemistry, which we call life, to emerge. Mars is a very good example of a planet which is just too small to sustain those conditions in our solar system. Mars might have had that window of opportunity very early in its history, and that's why we hope to find signs of life there. We're looking for life on Mars. But certainly today, Mars is a very harsh place.
What does it take for a planet to get water? Is it mostly asteroid and comet strikes?
Water on planets like the Earth, on rocky planets, that's a big mystery even today. We don't quite know yet whether water was part of the makeup of planet Earth, and for that matter, Mars and Venus, or whether it had to be delivered, so to say, later on after the planet was already formed by comets and asteroids coming from the outskirts of the solar system, where water in form of ice is much more plentiful. It is a big mystery. It seems to me that perhaps water is always available in small quantities in the rocks from which planets are formed. Mm-hmm. So perhaps all rocky planets have a small amount of water to fill up oceans on the surface.
Do we need to assume that only liquid water will work to sustain life?
We don't need to assume that only liquid water is the kind of solvent that would sustain and help life to emerge. There are other solvents which might work as well, though it has to be said that there is something about water which makes it particularly special. Water is indeed a very unusual liquid and solvent. It's very polar. It's the most electrically charged solvent that we have on planets. In addition, our listeners should know that we astronomers already have established that water is one of the most common substances out there in the solid universe, apart from stars and galaxies, which are mostly made of hydrogen and helium. Water comes pretty close to the top 10 of all substances. So it's not unusual that we'll be finding water on plenty of the planets out there. It's just water is very common.
Dimitar Sasolov is my guest. He's professor of astronomy at Harvard, also founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. His new book is called The Life of Super Earths: How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dimitar Sasolov. He is professor of astronomy and founder and director of the Origins of Life Initiative at Harvard University. His new book is called The Life of Super-Earths: How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Dimitar, our Earth obviously has the moon. How likely is it that other super Earth that might contain life would have a significant sized satellite like we do?
Our moon is a bit unusual. It's a very large moon for the size of our own planet. And we are looking for moons around those new exoplanets that we've been discovering lately. No luck yet, but I'm sure we'll eventually find some. And then we'll be able to answer your question precisely: how often do large moons happen to orbit other super-Earths? However, we think that moons do form relatively often, because in those last stages of the accumulation and formation of the planets, it seems that giant impacts, like the one which seems to have formed our moon, are common, and hence large moons may be there more often than we see them here in our own solar system.
So based on the definitions we've discussed already of super-Earths, it almost sounds as if our Earth is sort of on the outside of the range of possible environments that are really hospitable to life.
I would say almost on the outside, not really on the outside, thankfully.
We know it's working.
But very close to the edge. In other words, a really young sibling in the family of super-Earths. And the reason I make that statement and back it up in my book is because we see in our own solar system that all the rocky planets that are smaller than the Earth have different trouble in either keeping their atmospheres or having liquid water on their surface. The environments are very harsh, either extremely hot and inhospitable like Venus, or extremely cold and dry and no atmosphere like Mars. So it seems that the Earth almost made it into that range of planets which can have clement and nice climate conditions over a long period of time, and the Earth certainly has maintained those for 4 billion years now.
Should we assume that it is only planets that might have life on them, or could large moons possibly hold life on moons that are around other planets?
Well, we have Pandora in Avatar.
Well, that's what we all picture, right?
Yes, indeed. Large moons, particularly the size of our own moon and larger, could sustain good environments on their surface. There are two reasons why this would work. One of the reasons is that indeed giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn could have moons that are the size of a small planet itself. We have the moon Titan of the planet Saturn, which is in fact larger not only than our own moon, but larger than the planet Mercury. So if Titan was to be on its own orbit around the Sun, we would call Titan a planet. Now, Titan is really far out there, but it has kept hold of its atmosphere. And there are two reasons for that. First of all, it's relatively large, but more importantly, because it orbits a planet, just like with our moon and our own Earth, there are tides which are raised by this close orbit. And those tides tend to heat up the interior of the moon. And particularly in the case of Titan, and not only Titan, but other moons around Jupiter, this heat could be substantial and essentially keeps the large moon warm and active, and in fact tectonically active, over a very long period of time, which would normally not correspond to such a tiny planet.
So do you think that our definitions of life, and I'm glad you mentioned Avatar, because when we imagine life elsewhere in the universe, we sort of imagine that it would be as lush and look, at least in many ways, recognizable to us on Earth. Is that definition too limited?
Yes, indeed. In fact, that's the fascinating part of the question about life on other planets. Do we even know what to look for? And can we see it when we look? Are we going to be able to recognize it? In fact, that's the main motivation behind writing my new book, was because as an astronomer, I looked at the problem with the eyes of an astronomer and realized that in 10 years from now, we'll have evidence for different environments and atmospheres on many of those super-Earths and planets around other stars. Yet, we are completely unprepared to look for signs of life that are any different from what we already know here on our planet Earth. And that's a very narrow view of what life could accomplish. We know even on our own planet, with the history of almost 4 billion years, life has managed to do so many marvelous things, both in terms of ways to use solar energy, ways to inhabit the bottom of the ocean, different colors and sizes and forms. We can only expect to be totally surprised when we discover another form of life anywhere else. And I think, as an astronomer, we haven't done our homework yet as scientists to be prepared to look for life on other planets, unless we only look next door, like on Mars, where we can literally take samples. But when we look at distant planets, like the exoplanets we are discovering now, and where we have many more chances to be successful, we are actually not prepared for the possible diversity of life.
So let's talk about that diversity of life. For one thing, a lot of the previous searches have focused on carbon-based life forms, but this is not the only potential building block for life.
Carbon-based is indeed the structural essence of life on Earth as we know it. And chemists would tell us that carbon is a special atom. It builds scaffolding at the molecular level, which is unsurpassed by anything else. But indeed, carbon-based life is a shorthand of essentially saying that the biochemistry that we know here on Earth is a very specific biochemistry, and the entire diversity of the tree of life is rooted in a very narrow use of a particular set of molecules and their reactions. Now, this was what happened here on Earth, and we don't know whether it's because the Earth was a planet which particularly had the environments for this kind of life. What if the biochemistry is really environmentally dependent, and other planets would then have alternatives to our biochemistry? So this is where we can do our homework here in the lab, and particularly in trying to answer this very important question, which is a step towards the bigger question about the origins of life, namely, are alternative biochemistries possible? And even if we are able to show that even a single second example is possible, that will be a major breakthrough, both in science and in our ability to discover life elsewhere.
So, Dimitar, based on what we can assume about the genesis of life on this planet, how in the world do you begin to replicate conditions in a laboratory using potentially other materials to create life artificially?
Well, what we can do, and that's one of the reasons why I say in my book that we're at the threshold of a new world in terms of new materials. What we can do is try to replicate some of the basic functions of life. if not life itself, in its full glory. There are some functions like replication, like the ability to remember a certain chemical structure, to have a memory or coding for its maintenance and renewal. These are essential chemical attributes to any living form on this planet, which we have the tools now from our analytic chemical tools, as well as what we call chemical synthetic biology. We have the tools to build such molecules and to build the functions into them. So these are what we call minimal cells, which are essentially chemical bionic systems that replicate those functions. And as such, they do two things. Fundamentally, they allow us to study what about these basic functions of life is essential and depends on the environment. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I could subject a chemical reaction like that to the different conditions that I believe a certain planet would have and see what I get as a response. The second very practical aspect of this is that this resembles the development of the synthetic tools of organic chemistry 100 years ago, when the whole chemical industry became possible and brought us a real revolution in terms of industry of new materials and uses.
So once we, assuming that we're able to fabricate these artificial life forms, how do we take what we learned and apply it to conditions that, again, as you say, we can sort of imagine what they might be and based on observations, but we're not able to confirm any of this, right?
Indeed. Well, let me give you an example which would illustrate how this could work.
Okay.
Our own planet, in for that matter, the rocky planets in our solar system, as subject to a particular geochemical cycle, which is a global planetary cycle. We call it for short the carbon cycle. Now imagine that the carbon cycle and this cycling of carbon dioxide through the atmosphere, outgassing from volcanoes, and then back through rain and the continental rocks down to the oceans and back into the crust, under the crust of the Earth, and back again. That's why it's called the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's co-opted today by life, and life is a major player in the carbon cycle. But it's a cycle which is completely independent of life, could work on a planet which is not inhabited at all. However, it is essential to the basic environment and the biochemistry of life, because it provides all the chemical nutrients, as well as the stable temperature conditions and solvents that life uses. Now, we understand that while this is true for the Earth and the solar system, other planets like super-Earth around other stars may be subject to a number of other global geochemical cycles. One of them could be the so-called sulfur cycle, where instead of carbon dioxide, the major gas which is being cycled is sulfur dioxide. Now, it turns out that a planet like that may resemble superficially the surface conditions of Earth, but chemically it will be a very different environment across the entire planet, its atmosphere, oceans, and surface. So the question is, if we were to expect biochemistry to develop on a planet like that, would we expect that biochemistry to be similar or let alone identical to the biochemistry we have here on Earth? Hmm. Probably not, but right now we don't have a way to do these experiments in the lab unless we can replicate from scratch some of the basic molecules and functions that are necessary for a living system to emerge. And this is where this chemical synthetic biology and its bionic systems, which we call minimal cells, could help us answer a question like that. We could literally do the experiments and understand the chemistry of a potentially alternative biochemistry and answer those questions, and then know what to look for once we train our telescopes on such planets which show the signs of a sulfur cycle as opposed to a carbon cycle.
And when you talk about something like the sulfur cycle, I mean, the more we learn about really extreme places just on this planet, we recognize that there are, in fact, life forms that can thrive in places that we would not automatically assume would be hospitable.
Absolutely. That has been a real breakthrough in our understanding of life on Earth in the past 40 years. The discovery of the so-called extremophiles, microbes, mostly microbes with recent additions for a number of small worms, but mostly microbes, which can survive under conditions that are unthinkable for other life forms. However, we've also learned that these microbes are really bona fide members of the same tree of life and the same biochemistry, which makes us all up from microbes to humans. So they're more example of how adaptive and robust life is on an old planet like the Earth, where it manages to take advantage of all kinds of different geophysical conditions on the planet. However, they do not reflect a different biochemistry. Their basic chemistry is still the same, and they're members of the same tree of life.
Are microbes ultimately more robust than larger, more complex forms of plants and animals?
Oh, microbes definitely rule our planet. they have always done so, and they still do. Microbes are everywhere. They are almost 80% of the entire biosphere on this planet is in microbes. More importantly, microbes are everywhere on the surface of the Earth and under the surface, particularly very deep in the crust of the Earth and under the bottom of the oceans. So in those terms, life and the biosphere of planet Earth is virtually indestructible. Even if a major cosmic catastrophe wiped out the atmosphere and the oceans, the entire surface of planet Earth, there'll still be viable and thriving microbial communities 2-3 miles below the surface.
Dimitar Sasolov is my guest. He's professor of astronomy and founder and director of the Origins of Life Initiative at Harvard University. We're talking this hour about his new book, The Life of Super Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dimitar Sasolov. He is professor of astronomy at Harvard University, also founder and director of the Origins of Life Initiative at Harvard. His new book is called The Life of Super Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Dimitar, for the sake of this conversation, let's assume that all over the universe there are other super Earths that may have at least microbial forms of life. What kinds of accidents or lucky circumstances have to happen in order for more complex life forms to evolve?
It's a good question, but we don't know the answer. what we think is going on is, yes, the chemistry that underlies a microbial biosphere seems to have plenty of places to emerge, those planets and their environments, their surfaces. I certainly think there is a fair chance that there are plenty of those and we'll discover signs of life on other planets in the near future, and that near future is 10, 15, maybe 20 years. We are working hard in that direction. Now comes the second question is, how long does it take and how much does it take, and does it take any particular accidents or unique opportunities for that microbial biosphere to develop into something complex, something more successful in building particular functions that the individual microbes could not possibly master, and ultimately technological civilization, brains, and the ability to change the environment in a way which Darwinian evolution cannot. That's a big question, and it only can be studied with the single example we have here on our planet Earth. If we take that as a guide in what we could expect to find on other planets, then the answer is probably life starts fairly easily on some of these planets, meaning quickly the microbial biosphere takes over the surface, and soon we see the signatures in the atmosphere of the planet. But then it takes probably 2 to 4 billion years for the large entities like plants and animals to develop. And then it takes another maybe 0.5 to 1 billion years for any of those to develop the ability to think, if you will, mm-hmm. and develop a technological civilization. So I would say a good number for the transition from microbial life to something more complex and sentient is 4 to 5, maybe 6 billion years, meaning that our universe is probably not teeming with technical civilizations, but our galaxy may have quite a few already.
Is it reasonable to assume that where you have plant life evolving, you always have animal life and vice versa?
I think it is very reasonable. If we look at the history of life on Earth, as Stephen Jay Gould used to say, if you rewind the film tape, the movie will be very different and next time you play it, but there are certain basic rules, which is that as soon as there is oxygen and plenty of oxygen in the atmosphere and the oceans, which is thanks to the microbes, then you have enough energy to do things in large size and with much more oomph than before. And here you immediately get to plants and animals. And plants and animals are very similar to each other when it comes to genetic makeup and how they develop almost simultaneously on the surface of the Earth.
So your subtitle promises to tell us how all of this research could revolutionize life on our planet. What changes as we continue to study and learn more about the potential for life elsewhere?
I think there are two main things, and why I put it so high up in the subtitle of my book is, the first one is mostly our quest for more knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is one of the biggest questions of humanity. Is there life on other planets? Are we alone in the universe? And we just want to know and need to know. And the discovery of planets around other stars has really reinvigorated that quest and made it really something which we can reach, which we can accomplish. And it has its own, of course, philosophical implications for how we see our own place in the universe. But there is a second, much more practical aspect of all of this. And that is that this same motivation is bringing a lot of scientists from other fields, chemistry and biology, into asking questions which they didn't ask before and doing experiments they didn't do before, partly because there was no motivation to mm-hmm. do it. And this is where chemical synthetic biology and all the seemingly miraculous things it could accomplish come into play. And you can already see the first hints of what is to come. And particularly, as I mentioned, the promise of new materials, of a new era of equivalent to the synthetic organic chemistry times of the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. But this time, the materials will be much more organic, which will be materials which are self-adaptive, materials which can actually have memory and heritage, and where the software and the hardware are in one organic whole. This is qualitatively new way to work with synthetic chemistry, which is far more powerful and more adaptive to our human needs and the needs of the environment than what we have been able to do so far.
Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of professionals that make up your team at the Origins of Life Initiative?
On one hand, our team is made up of astronomers and planetary scientists who are discovering and studying those distant planets, as well as Mars and our own Earth. Then we have colleagues from geochemistry and actual chemists who provide the links to the rest of the team, who are molecular biologists and biologists that span the extreme of that spectrum.
Does everybody communicate well across disciplines, or has that been a learning process?
This has definitely been a learning process, and we are really lucky. I'm lucky to have a group of colleagues who truly want to work together, are excited and motivated by the common goals of this project. So it takes a special kind of motivation and interest and curiosity for scientists from such different disciplines to sit together and learn from each other and then work out experiments that they can do together.
So there are still, at least for the foreseeable future, limits to what we can know and confirm from here on Earth. For one thing, we can only travel so far, and we can only send spacecraft so far to relay data back to us. What are the other limitations in terms of trying to unlock some of these mysteries?
I think currently it seems to me our main limitation is what we know about life in the most basic terms of a definition and its basic nature. And this is something that needs to be done in the lab with new experiments and with all the ability we have now to synthesize complex molecules. On the other hand, when it comes to astronomy, the question has really started to shift from the astronomical aspect of are there environments and places out there which could be similar to Earth and good to life, which we seem to be answering to the positive now. And now this shift is towards biology, where the big question is it easy for life to emerge? How does life emerge under those circumstances? And my hope is that the work in the lab is really going to catch up with the exciting advances we've seen in astronomy and planetary science recently.
I think everybody probably would always answer no to this question, but are there ample financial resources to do what you need to do?
Well, I'm not going to say no, despite the fact that, yes, we
you could always
have to
use
look
more.
For more opportunities and more resources. I think until recently, the main issue and the main problem has been talent, mm-hmm. convincing people, especially young people, that this is one of the most exciting avenues for scientific research and breakthroughs in the near future. This is starting to change now. Our initiative has certainly tried to make that point for the last 3-4 years. And now that more people are coming into the labs and working on discovering these new planets, we certainly are starting to look for more resources for them to succeed in their careers and to be successful in what they're trying to do.
I think people typically think of scientists as being entirely grounded in verifiable fact. And at the same time, it requires a great deal of imagination to do what you do. I wonder how much time, if any, you tend to spend thinking about how the people who come after you, one or two or three centuries from now, will look at the work that you've been doing.
You're right. We scientists try to get something tangible in terms of experiments or in terms of theories, measurements with the telescopes. But there are moments, and I should say especially for us astronomers up on the mountain under the starry skies, this is easier to accomplish when you do think about the bigger picture. And that is one of those moments that made me write this book, because I realized that I was holding some knowledge of that big picture, which has come to us through the scientific efforts from many people in the past 10 years, which I wanted to share with everybody. And I think, yes, we are at the threshold of a very significant moment, not only in science, but in our ability as humanity to transcend the timescales of the planet, the timescales of the solar system. And that may as well be remembered not only by our future descendants, but many others in this galaxy, as the moment in the early days of this universe when biology became a real force in the bigger picture of this universe.
Because it's been, as you mentioned earlier, very recent since we've even understood that there are planets that might resemble ours at all, even existing in the universe.
Absolutely. It's been an old quest, starting with even before Kepler, with the Copernican revolution and the understanding that Earth is just another planet. It just was impossible to discover any of those planets. And it's very interesting that together with this final achievement of discovering and studying those distant planets, we understand how important it is to turn back and know a little bit more about what life is, who we are, and how our place in that bigger world matches to what we discover.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but in that time, I want to ask you about this. You wrote this book to be very accessible to non-scientists, and I must say I appreciate that. And I wonder what you think about the quality overall of science journalism today in communicating the kinds of groundbreaking work that you and your colleagues are doing to regular people who need to be informed about science.
I think it is something which needs to be done by both our colleagues, the journalists, and ourselves, the scientists, because ultimately it cannot be done just by the scientists themselves. We've tried that and failed miserably in the past. But we cannot also expect that our colleagues in the media could actually be up to date and understand all the intricacies of what we're trying to accomplish in the labs or on the telescopes. So I think what has happened with the availability of the internet is that we've come together, and this only bodes well for the future.
The new book by Dimitar Sasolov is called The Life of Super Earths: How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. Dimitar, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Velotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.